Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Will Joe Biden really be the Democratic nominee? How much pride can 1 month take? And will AI destroy humanity? We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by my friend and yours, Jeff Blair, Madeline Matty Kearns, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsor of this episode is Waterstone. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, MBD, I often rely on you to keep me posted on breaking news. And I learned of Joe Biden's fall at the Air Force Academy graduation ceremony via text from you. At first, I was like, is this real? Is this an AI-generated thing? We'll talk about AI more in a minute, because I really went down like a sack of potatoes. And I'd been following the ceremony a little bit through hostile Twitter feeds, hostile to the president. You know, they're pointing out how he had to be led around, and people are pointing at the ground constantly, and his speech was a little, had the usual rocky moments. But this was really, I thought, quite a disturbing fall, and I take no pleasure in it, as we've discussed previously. But I tweeted, you know, if you've had an elderly parent in decline, you know what this looks like. You know what this is. This is very familiar. Once the fall start, they don't stop. None of this gets better. But all these center-left people pushing back like us crazy, like, you know, we all trip, which we do, but that Joe Biden's just tripping the way all the rest of us trip, which is completely wrong. I mean, there's something, you know, his gait is very stiff. He's shuffling along. What do you make of it, MBD?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, I shared it with you immediately because it's sort of something we've discussed on the podcast where we've said this seems like something that could happen and it could be catastrophic. Now, I don't think this was not a catastrophic fall, but that was only by luck, right? I mean, if he had been closer to the edge of a stage or on a staircase or something like this, this could have been much more dire. It just, you know, my initial feeling is one that, you know, has been shared to me quietly by other people looking, when you look at some of these videos, which is like, I feel bad for him in some ways. I feel like, you know, it's the job of people around him to take care of him. And this kind of a job is, you know, beyond someone of this age, or this condition. You know, like, I have no ill will towards him. I think he just deserves rest, like I said, I am afraid that something like this is going to happen on a much bigger stage or on a, you know, in a way that is politically fateful, the way that Bob Dole's fall in the 1996 campaign event was, you know, very difficult. And it's interesting to see the sensitivities around this, because, I mean, I remember the late night jokes from the 90s about Bob Dole, you know, going in for his annual autopsy or, you know, like all these sort of things that late night comedians were saying. And it's just going to be harder and harder to keep the taboo against talking about or joking about Biden's age in place.
Yeah, it's been talked about a little bit, but not at a level that you would expect. But people already feel it and can see it, Jeff. We see it in the polling. I would just say two additional things. One, if it's not already sometime in the not too distant future, it's going to be unsafe for him to be out and about the way he is. And two, if you're a Democrat, there's just no way to know that he wouldn't have some terrible fall in October 2024, you know, that would lose the election to Donald Trump or someone else. So this has to be factored in, I think, into the conventional wisdom that Joe Biden is more electable than any other Democrat.
You know, Rich, when I saw him fall, my heart went out for him the same way it does for you. I am currently, as it happens, hobbling around on a broken foot because of a lifetime history of bad falls. And so I know the feeling. And I also know that if you're prone to them, it does only get worse with age. I think the thing that makes me so depressed is that we have to talk about both potential nominees for, you know, the presidency in terms of, well, what if a force majeure event intervenes to take them out of the running? Joe Biden could, you know, have a senior incident or a medical incident. You know, he could fall. Donald Trump, I mean, if he doesn't fall down a manhole, he could get arrested or get sent away.
He's definitely getting arrested. He's getting arrested a couple more times.
Well, yeah, we know. God help us all. I mean, what a carnival. But here's the point. What this really points up is, as sad as I feel watching Joe Biden struggle, this is why we can't have these aged people as our only choices for president. Do you know why people have a taboo against talking about Biden in the media? Because they know there's no better choice out there. At least in their opinion, they think that there's no better choice. They're obviously not Trump fans or Republicans. So they will not talk about how obvious it is. And that's why you aren't going to see it until the nightmare scenario that Michael describes, where he actually takes a fall that, like, you know, he has to go to the hospital for. And that's going to hurt to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Maddie, speaking of Donald Trump, we have this, I think it's fair to call it basically a war now between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump. It's very intense. I'm not sure it's sustainable at this level of intensity for the duration, but it is happening. It is on. And Donald Trump last night was back with another town hall, this time on Fox, where he's been scarce for some time now. What did you make of that?
Yeah, so unlike the CNN one, this was a very friendly set of questions. There were very softball questions. Hannity actually began by saying, you know, this was going to be very different from the CNN one. They weren't going to debate the candidate. And actually, in a funny sort of way, I think that works worse for Trump, because he is the, you know, two fingers up to the establishment candidate. He works well in an adversarial mode. It plays into his sort of victim narrative. You know, we've seen this, these things that should damage him only boost him, like indictments. And it was flat. It was quite boring. And I think this also adds some context to why we're seeing him really go after DeSantis in such a strong way. You know, the Republicans won't start voting for another 6 months. We can't really expect them to appear on a debate stage for another sort of 6 weeks or so. And yet he's really, really going for him. And I think it's, again, because this is the way he makes himself look good. Trump needs to exist in opposition to something. He isn't a coherent person by himself. He doesn't stand for anything by himself. He stands for something, opposing something. And I think that's what we're seeing with not just the fake news media, but now with DeSantis and his contestors as well.
So, MBD, you've obviously had the kitchen sink approach from Trump that he takes against every opponent. You've had a lot of various nicknames. Disaster is now in contention. Rob, you know, he's being called Rob. He's mocked. I guess maybe we've all been mispronouncing DeSantis all along, but he's been hitting on that and hitting DeSantis in ways that just opened him up to obvious counterpunches. You know, saying Andrew Cuomo was better than Florida is just crazy for Trump's purposes. But my question to you is, you're Chris LaCivita, you're a top Trump advisor, and he's going to take what you say seriously. How do you advise him to go after DeSantis?
I advise him to just alpha dog him, just big dog him the whole time, and continue blathering even incoherently to do it. I think I am of the opinion that magazine writers like ourselves, and probably much of our audience listening to this, you know, we all want like our candidates to prosecute the most coherent case against each other, right. Mm-hmm. And advance in very direct lines where you can trace, you know, their.
Yeah, we've disastrously overestimated coherence.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly. Voters want a vibe. Voters want a feeling, no, man. They don't want the cold case.
Listen, I really believe that, you know, like we want the personality to match the ideology, to match the campaign style, to match the governing, etc. And I think for Trump's core supporters, they accept that his attacks on other people are incoherent. You know, they cheer the ones they agree with, they ignore the ones they don't, and they just accept. They see this as a demonstration of his willfulness, and the appeal of Trump to them is that that willfulness can be put to work for some of my mm-hmm. political goals. So I really think that works for Trump.
So alpha dogging is just doing everything he's doing now?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not sure it will work in the end, because Trump, I do think even a lot of his supporters admit he has liabilities. But yeah, I would just keep up the barrage in as intensely as he can.
So Jeff, so far, and the DeSantis people are aware of this, as far as I can tell, DeSantis has been trying to show strength in response, and he hasn't shrunk from any of these mm-hmm. attacks, hasn't showed the least bit of fear or hesitation going back after Trump.
No, he hasn't, and I give him credit for that. I mean, if you can't do that, you're not going to take the crown, and it's as simple mm-hmm. as that. So, you know, you don't want to be over-aggressive, but you certainly cannot. You know, every time Trump hits, you have to, when you're confronted with it, hit back. It actually does behoove DeSantis to ignore some of the more ridiculous things. But, you know, if they bring them up to you, you have to mention the one, of course, everybody's talking about these days is that goofy, is it a truth, a tweet, whatever Trump did, where he like literally he issued a press release that was him reprinting his Truth Social thing, just making fun of Ron DeSantis's name. You talk about big dogging. I think that takes the idea to an extreme. And if I were Chris LaCivita, I would not be, because I would quit and I would go to work. I would become a Trappist monk after I had worked for the Trump campaign to repent. But if I were, I would tell him you have to be a little more measured than that, because even his fans were sitting there thinking, yeah, this is just embarrassing, though. They like that will to power. That was a brilliant insight that Michael had, honestly. They accept it, that he's going to make unfair attacks, but hey, all in the game, yo. But they don't want him to look like a fool. And when he goes and looks like a fool, that's the only thing that can possibly undo him in this little, you know, alpha mm-hmm. dog sweepstakes. When he doesn't look mm-hmm. like an alpha, he looks like he's trying too hard.
Yeah, it was interesting. He was asked, DeSantis, in an interview somewhere about this kind of Trump attack, the name calling and whatnot, and he said it's juvenile, et cetera, as you would expect, and then kind of went somewhere where I didn't necessarily expect him to go. He said this is why he lost.
Yeah,
and this is a critique like our types have made of Trump all along, which is obviously true, but has been kind of verboten to notice or to publicly notice for
Republicans.
And
I've never understood why, because the point about running against Trump is you have to make arguments that will resonate with his voters, not that resonate with the Washington Post. But this one will resonate with his voters, just like, hey, what did he do with Fauci and COVID? That should resonate with them. Yeah, it's a fantastic point. Like, you know, you had it and you squandered it because you couldn't shut up. People know it.
So next question to you, MBD, going back to Joe Biden, let's double barrel it. It would be sustainable for the president of the United States to be using a walker, yes or no? And what are your percentage odds at the moment that Joe Biden will actually be the Democratic nominee? Zero, no chance, 100%. It's a dead cinch lock.
I'm at 80% on the nomination question, and it would not be acceptable to use a walker. He could get away with a shillelagh for a little bit, leaning on one, but not a walker.
Maddie Kearns.
I think we're still pretty high that he's the nominee, so I'll say 90% there, and then I I also don't think it would be sustainable. It would be more sustainable than, say, him in a wheelchair with Kamala Harris pushing it. But
Jeff.
I said that long ago, one way or another, Joe Biden will not be the president of the United States in January 2025. I don't know how it will happen, but I think I still stand by it.
In a walker?
Oh, in the walker, as long as it's powered by Tesla. An electric Tesla-powered walker with Elon
green,
Musk branding.
It'll green
be,
walker.
It'll be a crossover. See, it'll please both sides. That's the idea.
So I don't think a walker would be sustainable either. And I'm lower than MBD and Maddie. I'm more like a 50-50 guy. And it's not because I think they're going to be these machinations, you know, to drop them if it seems like Trump's not going to be the nominee. I mean, if Trump's not the nominee, we're probably not going to know like till June of next year.
Right.
So it'd be hard to leverage him out at that point. I just really worry about whether he's
the health.
He's up for it.
That's mostly why I'm where I am too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that, let's hear from our sponsor this episode, Waterstone. When Patricia tried to donate to a conservative organization through her donor advised fund, her request was denied. Why? Because they said she was trying to give to a hate group. That's why she switched to Waterstone, a donor-advised fund dedicated to upholding Judeo-Christian values. Waterstone is unique in the world of donor-advised funds. It accepts gifts of cash, as well as real estate, business interest, oil, and more. They can help you receive an immediate tax deduction and make a difference for the charity of your choosing. With its charitable pool trust, you can even generate a guaranteed income stream from your charitable giving. Waterstone strictly adheres to a Christian statement of faith, including a pro-life declaration. It does not give to charities that contradict those values. Waterstone is trusted by so many men and women of conviction that they give $10 million per month in charitable grants. They can work with you or your financial advisor to make a giving strategy that fits your needs. Contact Waterstone's Giving Strategies team today for more information by visiting waterstone.org. That's waterstone.org. Please check it out. So Maddie, we are, second day of Pride Month? It already feels like it's been a month or more, right? There was a lot of lead-in to Pride Month this year, but we have continued Pride Month-related controversies. We have the apparel stuff going on. We talked a little bit about Target last time, but you have Kohl's and perhaps even J. Crew in the sights of folks on the right who think this stuff is way over the top. And you had a Toronto Blue Jays relief pitcher just sharing on Instagram a video from a Christian saying why Christians should support the boycotts of Bud Light and Target. I mean, he didn't even say anything as far as I'm aware of, and got backed into this groveling apology where he said he's so sorry for giving the Pride community, there's a Pride community now, offense, and said he was going to rely on the resources of the Toronto Blue Jays to better educate him so he could be better going forward. And it used to be, you know, the resources of a baseball team was like Hank, who had a cup of coffee with the Chicago Cubs and is the assistant bullpen coach who could help you work on your curveball. But no, now you're going to be educated in why your faith should not enter into your worldview whatsoever, and you should be fully on board Pride.
Yeah, so I think that was rather disappointing that he issued that apology. I mean, it smacks of I'm saying the thing I have to say so I'm not fired. Which, you know, easy for me to criticize that because I don't get fired at National Review for saying the things I say. So, you know, but I think what's different this year, at least what feels different about this Pride Month, is the LGBT movement has got to a place of relative complacency where they're used to asserting over and over again that their ontology of what it is to be a human being, what it is to, you know, your sexuality, what that means, that's the only way of seeing things. Everything else is bigoted. And that's just not true. Obviously, world religions have a very different interpretation of the purpose of sexuality. You've seen Robbie George at Princeton suggest that we do this Fidelity Month instead of Pride Month, sort of emphasizing fidelity to your family, to your country. These are the sorts of values that other people care about. And I think that they've overreached, especially with the trans issue. And we talked about this a bit last time with the nature of the products they were selling at Target. But they've overreached, and more people are willing to say, actually, I reject this. This is not, this doesn't represent me. This doesn't represent my view of sexuality or anything else for that matter. And they're feeling more confident to say so. Obviously, this Blue Jays player was not confident enough, but the fact that he shared it in the first place, it is a reminder that not everybody sees this issue the same way.
Yeah, so Jeff, it seems that a huge element of the backlash has to do with the LGBT. The emphasis has been on the T in recent years, and kids. You know, even the Dylan Mulvaney thing, he's a grown man, although, you know, he now denies the
man part of it,
and also has never act grown either, but he acts like a kid. So it feels like another a way of coming after our kids with this ideology, and this apparel that's been controversial in these stores also is for kids.
Well, the thing about it is that it's so interpenetrated into our culture these days that it's sometimes hard to notice. I was just joking with you guys before we started. It's like, oh, it's June? I didn't know it was Pride Month. Here in Chicago, it's Pride Year. It's Pride Decade, okay? We it's just like not even that much different. It's I'm sure it's a lot different to other people. But that in itself is a really good indicator of how absolutely interlayered it is with every part of your social and public existence these days. It's just you go out. And by the way, I'm not even complaining. I don't mind. But like everybody else, it's just one of those places where – you guys familiar with E.E. Cummings? Very left-wing poet. I can't believe I'm mentioning him on National Review. But there's a great poem of his called I Sing of Olaf. It's anti-war. It makes it even worse. Has one great line, though, where Olaf, after being beaten by everyone else to – he's got to admit it. He says, upon what once were knees, or upon what once were feet, there is some S I will not eat. And America has hit that moment where there's some crap that I will not eat. There's something I will not tolerate. And it finally found its crystallizing event in the kids and transgender issue. I didn't know that this would be the stopping point. I'm glad that it is. But this, to me, is very much a no-go further space. And they are determined to march further onward. And I think that there's a critical mass of people who are determined to say no. So I really do think this is where the war actually ends up happening in our culture wars.
Yeah, so MBD, that's a great segue to the question I was going to ask you. So, you know, we'd all become acclimated, for better or worse, with all the pride flags. You know, you'd complain about it every June, but the world kept spinning. But what is it about progressivism, cultural progressivism, that has to keep pushing? It's not as though they can just have the flag and add a few more stripes and symbols and be done. They want to push further into the culture.
Well, I mean, it is.
Wish we had an hour.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, one, there's the institutional question, right? Which is like, you've got the Human Rights Campaign, which is an enormous legal lobbying politicking group, and once Obergefell happens, it's not going to just disband, right? It's got a new, got to find the next mission, and so it's okay. We're going to push for more inclusion. Of more letters, TQIA plus, whatever plus stands for. And we're going to start shaking down corporations, you know, year by year, and telling them what we'd like to see from them. And finding a way to cajole and threaten them. So that's on the institutional level. But I think on the moral, political level, I really do think that progressivism has this world picture of we are always facing some form of tyranny, always in need of some form of liberation from it, and this is now bumping up against the limits imposed by nature itself. And so, yeah, I don't think they can stop. The world picture itself drives them there, and they can't shake loose of it. So if it wasn't, you know, and they sometimes lose, we have to mention that, right? I mean, I think people think that progressives always triumph, but, you know, in the 1990s, there was a vogue for legal emancipation of children from their families. And it got almost nowhere, right? Like, it was something even Hillary Clinton kind of hinted at supporting.
It takes a village, after all.
Right. You know, but expanding the definition of emancipating children from their the tyranny of the home. But it didn't go anywhere, so it's possible this will be stopped as well. But it's going to be a tremendous fight, because again, this is very deep in their worldview, and if I think listeners want, you know, the kind of 24-hour discussion or a picture of it, they should turn to a book by Carl Truman, The Rise of the Therapeutic Self, I think it's called. The Rise and Triumph of the Therapeutic Self, which I think really gets at why the culture has gone in this direction.
So, Maddie, asks a question to you. We have reached peak pride. Yes or no?
No, but I think it's going to... They're not going to take a hint. They're going to keep pushing, and then we'll reach it. So it's there on the horizon.
All right. Jeff, is peak pride upon us, on the horizon, or nowhere to be seen?
Just like peak oil never happened, peak pride will never happen.
MVD.
I mean, there's still more conceivable colors to add to the flag, right? And shapes, so...
I mean, there's always more paint in the can to mix. Trust me. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm gonna say we have not reached peak pride. The pushback is heartening, but we have not reached peak pride. So Jeff, let's go to something else here. AI, big debate been ongoing for a while now about the threats of AI, and you've had some prominent people warning that it could threaten the existence of humanity itself. How worried are you?
Well, I'm here actually to be the voice of reason and sobriety and say that, yeah, they're right. We may all be doomed. I'm actually pretty high on the panic meter when it comes to artificial intelligence. And people may think that's ridiculous, but here's why I am. Just to keep it short, I've written about this a couple times for the site. And I'm certainly going to write about it again. What AI does is it will not replace the smartest people in the world. And everybody is copacetic about that when they say, well, you know, AI couldn't write you a good poem. It can't do art. Well, sure it can, because it can't replace human randomness. But do you know what, unfortunately, AI can do? It can replace the vast, gormless middle mass of society and do their jobs better than they do them themselves. There was this hilarious story a couple months ago where a DEI office at some university like thought they had to respond to like, you know, some event somewhere else in the country that wasn't relevant to them. So they did a press release, and then at the end, the little auto text is like created with chatbot GPT. You'd never have known if it hadn't been written by a person. And there, proof positive that chatbot AI can replace the DEI industry. Now, that's great to me. I love that. But of course, what they'll do is they'll just do their jobs better than they're already doing them. You don't actually want that to happen. You don't want that kind of efficiency, and you also don't want that kind of human waste. Because joking aside, at the end of the day, what do you do with all those people who no longer have a purpose in life? I don't have a good answer. No one's got a good answer. I'm worried about it.
The question, Maddie, is... can AI write a decent right-wing opinion column? That's when the threat becomes dire.
They're programmed not to.
Yeah, that's what we have going for us. They'll never let it to a right one.
So I think it was funny the statement that came out from these guys within the field, which was like one sentence long. It was like, yeah, this could be on a par with nuclear threats and pandemics. And of course, because it's vague and people just start speculating wildly about the various forms that will take, I think the most immediate and obvious concerns are to do with reliability, given how much we rely on AI and are increasingly relying on AI. I mean, you only need to look around to see how much disruption can be caused when technology that we take for granted fails. So we had... Spirit Airlines had another episode where all their flights were suspended because of some glitch. We obviously had a wider problem with airlines last year. Then there's the issue of sort of, can you actually trust the information that you're getting? So there was an interesting case in New York. A lawyer was filing a suit, and he asked ChatGPT, the GPT, the to come up with, to provide him with similar lawsuits. And so it did. And he filed his brief. And it turned out that the ChatGPT had actually fabricated all of them. And so the judge had this sort of unprecedented situation where, you know, there wasn't fraud, but this was, he relied on something that proved to be completely unreliable. And then there's issues to do with, obviously, cybersecurity. You can get into, depends how deep you want to go into all this stuff, but, you know, quantum computing and quantum teleportation, where you can start accessing, you can start getting into very sophisticated cybersecurity, get behind them. So there's definitely, those things are on the horizon. They're concerning. I agree with Jeff, though, that the things that really keep me up at night are much more to do with how it changes what it actually means to be a human and how we conceive of this. He's mentioned, you know, the importance of work and having a purpose in your work. And if we move towards something like fully automated luxury communism or something, like, you know, that's not very good for...
Hey, look at what happens to people who sit in their rooms all the time and just stare at their computers. It's nothing good. We know it, yeah. Okay? This has, like, been documented very well, okay?
Exactly. So, I share that concern, and I also see it in human relationships as well. You know, we've already seen a very disturbing development of sort of sex robots, and sex robots with AI. So these are sort of like robotic girlfriends, I guess, which is, you know, very creepy and weird and changes human relationships and changes human purpose. And I think we can expect a lot of that kind of stuff because we don't have a coherent system of morality. We certainly don't have a consensus on morality in a post-Christian age. So that's where I would probably be spending a lot of time.
So MBD, I'm not as alarmed as Jeff and Maddie are. One, because I fall back on my traditional belief that every truly transformative technology, yes, has put people out of work, but has also generated other opportunities. So if you just look at what the economy was 200 years ago, you would think everyone would be unemployed because you don't need farmers the way you did to produce food. But we've obviously developed other ways. Sorry, there's a deer running across my lawn, so I was distracted there. We found other ways to employ people. And as far as the threat to humanity, maybe there is a threat to humanity. But if we say we're not going to do this because there's a threat to humanity, China or someone else is going to do it. And if a threat to humanity does develop from AI, you will need AI to combat this threat from humanity. And, you know, there's upsides and downsides to every technology. Social media, when it first emerged, you know, Facebook was like changing the Middle East and supporting these Democrats in the Middle East. And, you know, it turns out what it was really doing, Facebook and other platforms, kind of deranging our politics and poisoning the minds and ruining the mental health of our teenagers, especially teenage girls. So there'll be downsides to this, but there are downsides to everything.
Hey, Rich, remember in the 90s when the internet was called the information superhighway? Because it was just about getting all that info and becoming smarter. Yeah. Nah, that's not what it turned out to be after all.
Well, Rich, I share a little bit of your optimism, actually, maybe surprisingly. And I actually even would exceed it. I don't think that we've seen political derangement. I think we've seen a lot of political opening up and flowering of democracy and the smashing.
It goes both ways. This is true. Yeah.
And the smashing of some rotten institutions that deserve to be smashed in the intermediary space, namely mainstream media. So with AI, I mean, listen, we are all fascinated. There's a viral story this week that the U.S. Air Force did a simulation of a drone powered by AI that was given a mission to fly around, find a surface-to-air missile, then check back with a human operator, and the human operator would give the go-ahead to destroy it, the surface-to-air missile with the drone. And the drone immediately determined that the human operator was a threat and then moved to kill the human operator. Then when it was reprogrammed to not kill the human operator, it it immediately set about destroying the communication tower between the human operator and the
so
drone.
So that it could go and do its own thing, because it just wanted to get the points. It's so funny. It's like that's not Skynet-ish in the slightest, is it?
The thing is, this story goes around precisely because we believe in the Tower of Babel, and we believe in Frankenstein's monster, and we believe that technology is going to be our ultimate undoing.
Right.
And I don't believe that, actually. I don't believe that. I actually have high hopes for AI. Right,
come on, MED, you can't go this off-brand. You're going to have a Bud Light problem.
I actually think, you know, because everyone is extending it, like... So
techno-futurist MPD.
That demonstration was meant to show how dumb AI currently is and how much smarter it has to get and is getting. And it highlights the dangers that, you know, AI can be fooled if you don't program it well. It can be turned against us. And that's all fine. But, like, people are extending the idea that, oh, all the miserable things about our dumb internet are going to be extended into the future. Mm-hmm. Well, the miserable things about our dumb internet were the easier things to accomplish, which was like, let's make addictive TikTok and make you watch advertisements or whatever. But if AI is intelligent, it's actually going to be doing the harder things. And I can envision a future where AI is a tremendous tool for human development, where, you know, it can solve tremendous problems in education and in other fields that can't be solved by one human intelligence alone.
It's such a seductive point. I see it, and I still cringe. I just think about giving up agency, and that's a human impulse in me, and perhaps an irrational.
I don't think we will give up agency. And again, I actually agree with Tyler Cowen that you want the freer countries with the better institutions to be in the lead on this technology and its use, and you strengthen our institutions to protect us from it, and as much as we can. I mean, in a way, like I as horrible as living under the sort of Damocles of nuclear annihilation is, in some ways, like, it is true that the advent of nuclear weapons has brought about more peace.
Also, what would have looked like if we and had been wringing our hands like, okay, and nuclear is too dangerous, we're not going to pursue it, you know, in 1942, right?
Right, right.
How would that have turned out?
Right. No, that's exactly it. And again, I don't think this will be dangerous. I mean, I think a lot of the uses of AI that we're going to see in our lifetime are going to be stuff like, hey, we're replacing Duolingo with an actually intelligent language instructor that will actually get you to learn how to speak French or German, because it can actually customize the content to exactly your learning level, to exactly your interests, and it recognizes how you are stretching and your learning styles, etc., in a way that a single human teacher would have difficulty doing. And of course, after that, then what will happen is rich people will just hire human tutors that are themselves instructed by the AI in how to do it. Because humans will still remain, we will still prefer real human contact, like, because we are human.
So let's get specific and put a number on our level of alarm from 0 to 10. Maddie, you first. 0, you're totally copacetic about our AI future and killer robots coming. 10. You are in a panic, almost as afraid of AI as flying in an airplane.
I think Michael brought me down, so I'll say 5. I'll say 5. That, you know, I feel reassured now.
He brought you down in a different way than he usually brings you down.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So Maddie's dropped you down. Precipitously.
He talked you off the ledge.
Yes, precipitously down to a 5. Where are you, Jeff?
Oh, no, he's escalated me. Michael's been selling honey-tongued lies, the seductive lies of a techno future that will not actually exist. I'm still at about 9.1 as far as
9.1.
There's going to be enormous, massive people with nothing to do with their lives. And what are they going to replace it with? That's a thought that nobody's really contemplating. It's already happened. We're already seeing displacement in the modern, you know, mechanization.
I think
and sort of.
Lawyers, I'm sorry, but lawyers and lobbyists can be retrained to detail cars for plumbers and electricians and actually that useful people. Enjoy.
Learn to detail.
I will, okay, turn every lawyer into a plumber. I'm on board. Okay?
No.
I'm speaking as a lawyer.
No, but plumbers are skilled trade.
My old friend who was a plumber, I went to high school. I of course, went to college and law school. He became a plumber. I came back. He's making like twice as much as I am.
Yes.
You know what he said to me? He had a beard, cracked a beard. He said, you know what, Jeff? Plumbers don't starve. Simple as that.
I always tell people the story when I was moving my mom out of her longtime home into an assisted living place, and there was a basement plumbing disaster, and I had a young kid, a plumber, come, and he was just standing in the middle of this basement, saying nothing, staring up at the ceiling. I was like, finally, I was like a little awkward. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm thinking. Because he had to figure out, you know, where do these pipes go? Where's the best place to cut them? You know, it's a problem-solving job.
It's an intensely skilled job. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. And people degrade it because it's just like, you know, it's a dirty job. It's messy work. But my God, as I said, those people will never lack.
The AI will be employing electricians, believe me.
Well, yeah, that's true.
So, MBD, what's your number?
6. I'm a little worried.
Yeah, I'm going to – maybe I'll go 4. So Jeff, you're the real outlier here.
Usually
it's a good place to be.
As I said, you usually know, I might become a survivalist living off the grid in the shack just to keep Skynet away from me.
All right. Well, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been listening to middle-aged country music.
Yeah. So been listening to the new Dierks Bentley album, Gold. And the funniest thing is that a lot of Dierks Bentley's songs are about like middle-aged men, you know, learning to appreciate their family or appreciate their dad in their old age or get through a divorce or something like that. And yet my 8-year-old daughter seems to vibe with these songs from the backseat of the car in a really strong way and requests him all the time, which is just the funniest thing in the world to me. And I think I'm going to have to take her to a Dierks Bentley concert this summer.
So, Jeff, you've been listening to a 1972 live concert from the Grateful Dead.
Oh, not just one, my friend. As Deadheads, well, you know, it's funny. The Grateful Dead has that hippie kind of mystique. But, of course, there are a ton of conservative Deadheads out there. I happen to be one of them. I love this live band. And I've just been doing nothing but listening to Europe 72. Every fan, who knows, every show. I've literally set myself a task of going from April to May of 1972 just listening to Americana played over across the pond, the best Americana maybe that's ever been done in the rock genre, in my opinion. I love it.
So, are you familiar with Leonard Skinner's Oakland Coliseum, July 2nd, 1977 concert?
Not that particular one. Why that particular one?
It's I'm not a huge music guy, certainly not anything in your ballpark, but I love Sweet Home Alabama, and I came across that rendition of it from this concert, which apparently is epic and legendary, but it is amazing.
Hey, you want to hear something even funnier? Remember, that song was written as an insult to Neil Young? Well, right after the plane went down, and of course Ronnie Van Zant died, the day afterwards, you can find a tape of Neil Young out on the stage with his band, just playing the most, you know, butt-kicking version of Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh, that's awesome.
As a tribute.
Oh, I got to check it out.
It's beautiful. Yeah, soul. All out of soul.
So, Maddie, you are about to go see a Jerry Seinfeld performance.
Yeah, so I'm in Rochester just now visiting my husband's family, and they organized this surprise, which was really sweet. So we're going tonight to see Jerry Seinfeld. I always think it's a bit of a risk going with family to comedy shows, but I think Seinfeld's pretty safe, you know, he keeps it clean. So, yeah, really looking forward to it.
So I saw The Little Mermaid, and it was terrible. It was really awful. And it's not the woke stuff, really, which isn't that noticeable. It's too long. Kids' movies should be like 90 minutes, not 2 hours and 15 minutes. And it felt more like 3. And it's really hard to replicate the magic of the animation with the live actors. And then the woke stuff, the African-American Ariel, I mean, she's lovely. I mean, she's a lovely girl, but I'm not sure it really has the effect that they wanted, because you have this sort of teenager, I don't know whether she's a teenager, teenager-ish, African-American girl, like pining after this hunky, you know, grown-up white male, and then rendered mute throughout most of the movie. So on kind of woke standards, it would seem like it kind of backfires, and it just sort of lacked magic. So I highly do not recommend it. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is Noah Rothman's From Trump Avoidance to Anti-Trump Pile Up.
That was mine yet again.
Oh man,
we really got to start coordinating.
Well, listen. I think you could pick almost any of Noah's pieces on the 2024 race in the last week and a half. I think, you know, we all knew Noah was a very capable foreign policy commentator from his tradition inside of the movement, and a very good cultural commentator as well, with his recent book on the new Puritanism. But he's just also just a great rank punditry pundit. And, you know, you should follow his coverage of the 24 race. He's always insightful and always makes you think.
Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is a corner post by John McCormack called Why It Makes Sense for DeSantis to Hit Trump on Abortion. And it delivers exactly what the headline says. But it, I think a lot of people can criticize fall into the trap of criticizing DeSantis for attacking Trump from the right and saying, you know, this is very 2016 Ted Cruz strategy. But actually, John lays out very clearly why that is a very smart move.
Jeff, what's your pick?
Well, I'm going to go with one that's very much at the heart of my current political obsessions. This is our local Wolverine, Jim Garrity's piece from the other day. Trump 24, 2024 is shaping up to be even dumber than Trump 2020, which goes back to my old thesis, which is that no matter how bad you think things are getting politically, they can always get stupider. And then they're about to now, once we're going to go through this juvenile name calling cycle, the one that we just discussed earlier, we have not seen what's coming over the horizon yet. We think we know what we'll see. I guarantee all of us, we're going to be surprised.
So my pick is our editorial, Virginia Joins the Movement Against Credentialism, praising Governor Glenn Youngkin for signing this bill in Virginia to eliminate the requirement that you have a four-year college degree for many state jobs or some specialized state jobs, obviously, where a degree is necessary, especially medical jobs. But otherwise, this is really healthy and welcome pushback against the idea that if you don't have a four-year degree, you're somehow inherently less capable than people who do. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or recount of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Waterstone, and thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.